Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy talking about Chicago's forthcoming Summer of Joy. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about the public officials who have public safety responsibility, because we should. But remember, politicians mainly are reflections of at least some community sentiment. Most politicians, not thought leaders, they form at the back of the parade once an idea or a movement is afoot so that they can pander their way to public office and try to stay there. That's certainly the experience in Chicago and Illinois. Form at the back of the parade. So there's something they're appealing to, even when they make statements or take positions that we might find outlandish. So this Chicago police officer who posted on Facebook about her stop at a Pilsen bookstore, Pilsen Community Bookshop. Mm-hmm. She stopped in to buy a Bible. She posted online, "Today I passed by my beloved Pilsen, stopped at a bookstore to buy a Bible for my home. Recently bought one and it's small, so I figured I'd get something bigger. When I walked in uniform, I was told I couldn't be in there because of my equipment. I told her I was on duty and could carry. She went on to say, quote, this is not a cop-friendly space.
Yeah, it's a police-free store.
As a gay Mexican-American woman who served her country and continues to serve her community, I'm shocked and heartbroken. My beloved Pilsen, my home, my barrio, where I've lived for 7 years and still own a home there, I'm embarrassed and heartbroken for the way she treated me, I promise you. I didn't get mad as I walked out, but my voice did crack when I told her how, as a woman, a Mexican, a member of the community, I couldn't believe what she was doing. Thanks, Pilsen Community Books. Promise to never go there again."
And again, the bookstore, Pilsen Community Books, 1102 West 18th Street. They put a statement out on social media saying ownership wants to keep the store, are you ready, a welcoming and safe space for vulnerable people and free of police.
That's right. Nothing says lack of safety like police officer.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
I know at least the WGN report on this that the Pilsen Chamber of Commerce nor Alderman Lopez, 25th Ward, decided to comment on this. Of course not. So my point there is, okay, so, I appreciate the officer giving us her intersectional score. That's sort of secondary. The defund the police, the idea that police equals unsafe.
Right, that it's not a safe space if a cop is in your safe space.
So that's an attitude. It's not an attitude I think that's shared even by a majority of the city. At least the polling suggests it's not. But it is an attitude that is pervasive among certain demographics, particularly ideological ones. White, black, Latino, other ideological ones across race and intersectional scores. And it turns out to be a bit of a problem because that's something that the socialist aldermen who've been elected will pander to. That's something that the socialist mayor who was elected will pander to and have, and the Cook County State's Attorney and the Cook County Board President and so on and so forth. So I just want to recall this story because it's indicative that the mentality, the poisonous mentality that afflicts Chicago runs in both directions, runs up from the populace to the politicians and reverberates back down. They're not taking these positions solely because they're ideologues. They're ideologues with ideological fellow travelers in the electorate who support their candidacies, you see. And the mentality, too, is just something I think should be addressed. Not all cops are heroes.
No.
This binary, you're either, standing at attention on this side of the thin blue line or that side. No. I've had run-ins with cops that were not enjoyable. I mean, traffic citations and the stuff.
Speeding, Dan, we know.
You run into cops. I know cops that are jag-offs that get off on a little power trip for the little fiefdom of power they have for 8 hours a day. They're annoying, some of them.
But there are also some very wonderful people, family people, Christian,
good
people.
Yeah, fine, whatever.
Care about that.
Good for you. Because there's good family people in every profession.
Yes.
It's such an important comment.
Sorry, Dan. It's not your comment. That's how I feel.
I know. I mean, feel your feelings, because I know that's what you do.
And by the way, Alderman Lopez did make a comment. He said it's absolutely disgusting on so many levels. He's Alderman of the 15th, the Alderman of the 25th, another Lopez. She declined to comment, or he declined to comment.
Yeah, Ray Lopez, but the 25th Ward Alderman didn't comment. So the point here is thinking, not just feeling. I know that's important.
Well, what do they have a right? It's a privately owned bookstore. Do they have a right to let in whoever they want and kick out whoever they want?
Yes.
That's why I'm not visiting this bookstore.
Oh, were you going to go otherwise?
No, I wasn't
pick up a Bible?
Pick up a Bible, yeah. But they said that they're, we know that we keep us safe, that our community folks come through here every door. Organizers, teachers buying books with their own money for their classroom.
Yeah.
Parents hoping to expose their children to books that will help them imagine and create a better world.
Right.
These people are our community.
The socialist parade of horribles. Yeah, we get
always
it.
Welcome.
But the mentality that needs to be addressed, if there's thinking that's going to happen, thoughtful conversation that's going to happen in the city, I don't know if it's possible. Probably not. So you've had some experiences with the police that you don't like. You know a cop that you don't like. How do you get from there to defund the police? How do you get from there to saying that the police are the enemy? How do you get from there to saying, I don't want police protection? That's the logical jump that a logical person cannot make.
Well, they're known for printing always carry a book merchandise, which I guess shares anti-cop slogans, and they've raised money for jail reform groups. So they've been anti-police for a long time.
Jim in Crown Point.
Doesn't make it right.
The bookstore has the right to stop the police from coming in there. Just like the baker had the right to refuse a gay couple's request to make a wedding cake. So the bookstore, though, will have to hopefully withstand the blowback from this. And it would be ironic if they got held up. That's all I'm going to say.
Thanks for the call, Jim. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that. The police are not a protected class.
Right.
And so you run into, obviously, anti-discrimination law. You legally, philosophically, we could get into it. You legally couldn't, refuse service to somebody who came into that bookstore because they're black or because they're Latino, not
or
that
gay.
They would. Or, well.
Or can you?
Protected, you protect class in Illinois? No, you couldn't. So there's protected classes. Cops not a protected class. Your profession doesn't make you a protected class, at least not yet. And so it's a little bit different in terms of the legal attitude. But it's more the cultural issue here. You want to know why the city is up for grabs in part is because you have people in neighborhoods that are beset by violence who look past the perpetrators of the violence and have come to believe that the people who are trying to provide for public order are the enemy. I mean, that is a suicidal ideology, but that's the left. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, Jake from State Farm, we need a comment.
Yeah, this is disturbing.
State Farm Insurance, Bloomington-based for now.
If they're smart, they'll move out. It's only a matter of time.
State Farm Insurance encouraging its agents in Florida to donate books promoting transgenderism to five-year-olds to their local schools or public libraries, according to email shared to the Washington Examiner by a whistleblower, somebody who works for State Farm.
Yeah, these are employees who are, they want them to volunteer and do this.
State Farm has partnered with Gender Cool Project, which promotes issues of gender identity in children through various advocacy and public awareness programs. Donate a packet of three books to local schools and public libraries. The three books, a kid's book about being transgender, a kid's book about being non-binary, and a kid's book about being inclusive.
And they're targeting kids as kids age five and up. Mm-hmm.
Email to Florida agent. This was a copy of it to Florida agents, since State Farm is now denying it.
Oh, really?
Or they were initially, and then I think they're, and then I think they tried to recast it. Now I think they're walking away from it.
Well, 550 State Farm agents nationwide are participating in this, so they can only deny it for so long.
We are seeking six agents in Florida that would be interested in participating in this unique project by receiving these books in March, then donating them to their community by the end of April. Along with donating the books, we would encourage the agent to highlight our commitment to diversity on their social media pages. The internal State Farm email, State Farm is partnering with the Gender Cool Project to help diversity classroom, community center, library bookshelves with a collection of books to help bring clarity and understanding to the national conversation about being transgender inclusive and non-binary. That's the internal email.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636, type in DA. Then a quick comment. This is why I'm glad I have USAA insurance.
By the way, the books that they're seeking to donate would be prohibited in classrooms under the parents' rights law that was signed by Governor DeSantis. Take judicial notice of that, prohibiting classroom instruction on gender identity and sexual orientation through third grade, and again, targeting five-year-olds. In a statement to the Washington Examiner, State Farm defended the program, saying it's strictly voluntary and that the strategy of the program has involved parents are not being asked to share with schools. At State Farm, we're committed to diversity, blah, blah, blah. Those just aren't words, blah, 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 blah.
Well,
blah,
why can't
blah,
they
blah.
Just sell insurance, Dan? That's all we just want. A lot of people just want.
Strictly voluntarily and has involved, no longer includes schools. Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, but if your boss is into this and he sees you making an effort, putting things on your social media, and then there's time for a promotion between you and another employee, who do you think he's going to pick?
Gender Cool's corporate sponsors, gendercool.org, if you'd like to peruse them. Dell, Intel, Intuit, HP, Adobe, Bayer, CB Richard Ellis, Oracle, Allstate, State Farm, Jones Lang LaSalle, Prudential, AbbVie, Bank of America, NBC, Universal, Nike.
This is a longer list. Those are some pretty big names.
They are some pretty big names. You think we're winning? You think sanity is winning? Biological boys and biological girls, biological men, biological women. You think you're going to keep biological men from competing in women's sports? You think you're not going to be compelled to participate in a lie? Think you're winning? Feel like it? I know this was the position of many conservatives. Never happened. Ryan T. Anderson, who I have great respect for. Oh, no. Once they start to undermine women's sports, then it's all over for the LGBTQIA identitarians. Really? Does it seem like it's all over to you? The founder of Gender Cool is a woman named, by the way, she wants you to make sure her pronouns are she and her, just so you know.
Okay. What are your pronouns?
Jennifer Grosshandler is her name. And last year she published an op-ed in the USA Today. I'm a lifelong competitive athlete and a mom. Transgender athletes aren't a threat to women's sports.
Oh, please.
She has apparently a daughter who identifies as a son, you know, a girl who identifies as a boy, I think. She has a trans kid is the point. And I'm not talking out of school. She discloses it as the inspiration for creating Gender Cool in this op-ed. And she talked about how she played sports all her life, and she was a state-ranked in tennis in Georgia, and women's sports has defined my life in the deepest and more profound ways, and so on and so forth, all of the setup to the reveal. And she writes that the truth is sports is not her thing, her trans daughter's thing, But she likes to be in and around it. She goes on to say that these bills banning, which are now laws in a dozen and a half states, that prohibit men from competing in women's sports, she calls them bad bills based on fiction. These bills, now laws, seek to dry up an entire ocean for kids who simply want a few drops of water. I found the overwhelming majority of trans and non-binary kiddos just aren't that interested in the competitive side of athletics, and the tiny percentage who are not the fastest fish in the sea. They're not the strongest, the most agile, the most competitive. On the contrary, the running joke, or it's a running joke among so many of our families, that whoever finds the secret to getting our kids to move will have a building named after them. Aren't you fun?
I don't know what world she's living in.
Well, this probably is before Leah Thomas rose to prominence. She said policies developed by medical experts have been in place at the NCAA and Olympic levels for years now, allowing trans athletes to compete, and yet we have never seen a transgender woman in the Olympics or any kind of domination of women's sports by transgender athletes.
This definitely was written before Leah Thomas.
Well, this is last year.
Okay.
Well, transgender women in the Olympics.
What is she talking about? We had a weightlifter.
Yeah, exactly. Transgender girls and women are not, never will be a challenge to women's sports, and so on and so forth. Women's sports is as much about lifting each other up as it is about winning. Our values, our fundamental beliefs, even as competitors, should be grounded in celebrating all who simply want to belong. Why are you against belonging? If you're not for men participating in girls' sports, then you're against belonging, and you're not for inclusivity, and you're not for sharing. And you're not supporting Jake at State Farm.
Jake. Oh,
is that right?
I mean, is anybody going to leave State Farm over this? I don't know. That's why I didn't want the NFL players to wear pink. I just wanted to watch football. Didn't want to see, you know, the distraction. You just want to buy insurance. You don't want to have a distraction. Or is that the wrong way that I'm thinking?
Well,
I just want to keep politics out of things.
Well, you're a coach of girls' sports.
Yes, so I am.
You're not going to be able to ignore it. So what do you do? You can pretend it doesn't exist, but you know it's going to be visited upon you in some material way as this momentum continues to roll downhill like an avalanche.
And it's here. I mean, it was here 3 years ago when we played a girls' championship game in two. Dudes showed up, but we absolutely destroyed them because they weren't as good as my girls. But that's just the beginning because that was just but it hasn't happened since.
Yeah, well, that's
but it's happening in other places.
So you're making Jennifer Grosshandler's argument, which to me is completely irrelevant. I don't care if the men participating in women's sports are dominant or not. That's not the fundamental point. The fundamental point is that men and women are different, and men and women shouldn't be participating in sports together in a competitive way, because it's inherently unfair and
it's also dangerous.
Well, yeah, it can be. I mean, if
when are you
kidding me? When you're a dude who beats up a woman in a UFC fight, sure.
Oh God, that was repulsive. I couldn't even watch the first round.
But this idea, like, if as long as the man isn't winning the trophies, it's okay. No, it's still not okay. So, do you want to participate in this lie or not? Are you going to be backed down by the inclusivity police or not? I'll bet you most people will be backed down by them. And you know how I know? Because that's actually what's happening right now. I'm just observing what is true. Is it not? John in Bridgeport, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, guys. Two things. Going back to 2016, I felt the pulse of the public was that no one like us had a say. So that's why someone like a Donald Trump came around and says, no, you do have a say. Just elect me and I'll push back. And that's what pissed off the levers of power, whether it was in industry, business, or in politics. And they still haven't gotten over it, but too damn bad. The second thing is, Dan, you just made the point reading that person's statement for single gender education. It's at that point in the formative years, especially in high school, that the girls realized what it means to be a girl or a female.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, did we lose John?
Yeah. John, are you there?
Oh. Sorry. Go ahead, John. I don't know. You clicked off for a second, but you're talking about single sex education.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think people will be happier if you're able to find a way to send your child to a school like that, as opposed to a government school. And nothing against your kids, Amy, but it's kind of messed up right now. And the single gender education, we know that females learn differently than boys, and that boys are more competitive at an early age than females are. It's just a natural thing. I don't know if you get in trouble for saying that, but
I know a lot of competitive females. A lot.
I'm not denying. Not denying that. But if you go in the classroom. If you go in the classroom, the boy will be like, I'll bet you $20. I do higher in a test than you. Girls aren't like that in the beginning. As they come across in the formative years, they do become like that. But what's happening now is a social experiment with boys and girls, and the system wants you to forget what you are or what you're made to be. That's all.
Thanks, John. Sheila, Arlington Heights.
Hi. I just have a comment that I think things will change for the woke community when girls have to register for the draft at the age of 18, just as my son had to register for the draft. Since the lines are blurred between what's a boy, what's a girl, I think girls need to register the draft
Selective
on their
service.
18th birthday.
Yeah, we did that.
Thanks for the call, Sheila. You think that would change anything? I don't. You think they're afraid to send
women
girls off to their death? Do you understand how committed they are as ideologues? You understand this is religious to them? You think they won't take it to whatever ridiculous extreme you can imagine that's consistent with the path that they have set the society on? You don't think they do that?
Well, as of January 2016, there's been no decision to require females to register with Selective Service or be subject to a future military draft.
Yeah, okay.
Following a unanimous recommendation.
Do you think they would do it?
Staff. I don't think they would do it, no.
Why? What in how they approach things suggests to you that there is anything that would restrain them? There's anything they won't do in service to their identitarianism. Right. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Yeah, no, they definitely would. It's the die agenda, but it's also the day agenda, as in Latin, DEI, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion. It's their God. That's what they are.
Well, what are the rules?
They're the day, and we're supposed to die. That's what it is. Anybody who doesn't agree with their agenda is supposed to die because they're the day.
Well, that's right. Thanks for the call, Frank. They're certainly willing to see people sacrifice for the greater good.
So, Dan, let me ask you, and I don't know if anybody even knows the answer. What if you are transitioning from male to female? Do you sign up for Selective Service? Are you exempt from doing that since you're becoming a female?
Well, given where our military is, that you are whatever you say you are. That's been the approach from Lloyd Austin at Secretary of Defense, as far as I can tell, and in the military as it has gotten woke across all the armed services. So, no, I'm a woman. If I say I'm a woman, I'm a woman. Okay.
And then you don't have to sign Frank up for Selective Service.
Frank in St. Charles.
Yeah, it should be pointed out to some of these crazies that there's no law or anything prohibiting a trans person from competing in sports. You just have to compete in the category that you were born, male or female. That's all. But you can compete in sports.
Right.
Well, what about having the third category, a transgender category?
Yeah, I mean,
that you need a lot of participants for that. That's,
yeah,
to field a team, whether it be
and oh, by the way, if you have a trans category,
yeah,
you have the same problem, don't you?
Oh yeah, you're right, Dan.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, what the hell is your friend Marian Ahern doing over at NBC5?
What do you mean?
There are two Republican gubernatorial debates scheduled for tonight.
Right, one at 5 and one at 9, right?
Channel the 9? WGN one is Rabine, Sullivan, and Bailey.
Yeah.
The NBC one, if it goes off, is Irvin, Solomon, and Schimpf. So,
what is that?
It's not like there's 10 candidates in the race. WGN required you be at least at 5% of the polls to participate, so that would have knocked out Solomon and Schimpf.
Right.
So now NBC5 is bringing in these also-rans, as much as I like Max Solomon from what I've seen, that's what he is, these also-rans, Schimpf and Solomon, to give the appearance of a debate with Richard Irvin. Did Ken Griffin buy NBC5 and I didn't know about it? How do you schedule? How is it that NBC and WGN can't get together and schedule their debates on different nights through the course of a primary season?
Oh, I smell a rat. Because remember when you ran for governor, how many candidates were there? What?
Seven.
Seven? You all fit on stage just fine.
Yeah.
Right?
When
we had 19 candidates, they did a forum or a debate, and every, you know, like 17 of the 19 showed up.
Well, you
You don't do this. This is unheard of, Dan, and you know this too.
There was a couple of splits, like, I think TTW did us all together. But I think there were maybe in forums around the state, there was a couple of splits. But for the most part, the network affiliate televised debates. What do voters want to see? They want to see all the candidates side by side and size them up side by side.
And we don't, like Solomon, nobody even knows who he is. I'm sure, you know, I've heard wonderful things about him and Schimpf, but it is a three-way race or four-way race between Gary, Darren Bailey, Sullivan, and Irvin. Well,
right now it's a two-way race.
Okay.
I mean, right now the numbers say it's a two-way race.
Between Bailey and Irvin?
Yeah. I'm not saying that can't change over the next 4 weeks because it's a volatile situation. There's still a lot of undecideds, but right now it's a two-man race.
Then those two men need to be in the same room on the same TV station face to face.
Well, of course, and frankly, to be fair, for those that still have a puncher's chance, they should be on the same stage with the other two candidates that right now are topping the polls that are in a dead heat. And even if you want to include Schimpf and Solomon, that's fine. I'm not for excluding anybody. If you want to include them, you can still put six on a stage. This does not make any sense, both in terms of the distribution of who's debating where, and the fact that NBC and GN can't get their act together to schedule the debates on different evenings.
Unless this is the best that they could get. Because sometimes, you know, because the candidates really are in control. And if Irvin, I don't know. I mean, I smell a rat, don't you?
Yeah,
I've been around this town. You've been around this town. You've been in the game. And this has never happened before. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Irvin ducked the GN debate because that's where the other three were going to be. And NBC5 provided him a soft landing spot. And then the other three over at GN that are debating on GN said, well, we're not going to go over to NBC5 to accommodate Irvin. And so now, so then NBC5 comes up with throwing in Schimpf and Max Solomon and whoever else they can drag in off the street, and they pretend they're having a debate. And my understanding is that Marianne Ahern is saying, well, this was the only night we had studio time. Please stop.
I could find out. Try and find out who, okay.
It's just such a disservice to the electorate, and it's just more evidence of trying to wire things up. And it's just, well, I don't think it's going to fly, but, you know, I've been wrong before. I could be wrong again.
Well, which one do you want me to watch? And then you want to watch the other one?
Well, I mean.
Or do we just take highlights for both?
Look,
I will watch one, but now I don't know.
Max Solomon strikes, I mean, if that debate even goes off, Max Solomon strikes me as a smart guy, so he could probably take Irvin to the woodshed if he was so inclined. And Paul Schimpf knows a lot more about state government and, frankly, military service than Richard Irvin does. So, I mean, even though it's also Rand's with Irvin, if that debate went off, that doesn't mean he's going to get a walk if those other two gentlemen decide they don't want to give him one. And then, you know, we'll see what Bailey, Irvin, and Rabine have to say on GN. But the problem is Bailey, Rabine, and Sullivan are going to be debating a guy who's not there. They're going to spend, I would suspect they're going to all spend their time piling on Irvin, who's,
who's
across
there.
Town at NBC5.
This is so ridiculous. I'm going to send an email out to the general manager.
And Richard Irvin, I will see if he's more ready for prime time than he's been so far when he's done the sparing interview with some political reporter within the Chicago Press Corps or had a press conference, because he's still struggling to answer the question as to whether or not he voted for Trump in 2016 or 2020.
Yeah, even the downstate reporter tried to get the answer yet again.
Mayor, did you vote for President Trump in 2016 or 2020?
You know, when I in general elections, I'm Republican. I always vote for Republicans.
So is that a yes?
And he's looking away.
General elections, I always vote for Republicans.
Go ahead. But you voted for President Trump, yes.
That's, a number of media outlets want to talk about the White House and national politics. This is about the state of Illinois. That's exactly what J.D. Pritzker wants to be talking about. Anything other than his record, comparing my record and successes as mayor of the second largest city in the state of Illinois to his failures of the state of Illinois. You know, as long as we're talking about other things, national politics and the White House, we're not talking about what we need to move Illinois forward. And that's what we need to be talking about. When I go around this state talking to people, let me tell you what they're interested in. They're interested in making sure that, that their kids are safe and not getting shot. You know, the crime is under control. They're interested in making sure that the taxes are low and they're not taxed out of their family home. They're interested in making sure that there's no corruption in the state and we're able to move forward and actually do work on behalf of the people. That's what they care about.
Well, and I asked though, Mayor, because your campaign is sending out mailers that are basically saying that Jesse Sullivan and Darren Bailey are secret agents for the Never Trump agenda, insinuating that, Darren Bailey supported President Biden. Do you think it's fair to make those attacks on your opponents when you won't definitively say whether you voted for the president or not?
Listen, this election is about comparing records, comparing backgrounds. I was attacked by all of these folks and all of my opponents on both sides of the table, Republicans and J.B. Pritzker, even before I formally announced. It's important that we point out everybody's record. Those are their words. That's their background. We want to point it out so our voters know who the people are. During campaigns, people say a lot of things, but it's important that we get their records out, and that's what it is.
But isn't part of that record of, establishing and saying on the record who you did vote for, especially if you have these mailers, calling attention to that to your opponents?
Listen, as I say, this is about comparing records, and the people of Illinois will see based on the comparison, who is the best person, you know, to take David Prisker out come November?
Can I get one, one last one?
I love the kid in the background going, uh-oh.
Is that impressive? Is that that's the superstar in the making that Ken Griffin and the surrender Republican establishment have thrown in with? Does that impress you, what you heard from Irvin there again?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Or you can always text us at 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Yeah, let's compare the records. Let's do that.
Okay.
Here's a new ad that's up as of yesterday from the pack that I'm running. Here's the 30-second version. You'll hear the 60-second radio version on our airwaves soon enough.
You can put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
Virulent people, some of them the dregs of society.
When Hillary Clinton called you deplorables and Joe Biden said you were the dregs of society, Richard Irvin was right there with them. When Irvin ridiculed Trump as an idiot and a bigoted racist, he wasn't just saying he doesn't like Trump. He was saying he doesn't respect you. Respect yourself. In the Republican primary for governor, vote for, you know, a Republican. Join conservatives in voting no on Richard Irvin.
It's funny, you know, he's focused on the state of Illinois. He doesn't want to talk about national politics. Well, he was happy to talk about national politics when he was mayor. He texted that city employee, former friend of his, that Trump was an idiot and a bigoted racist.
Yep.
He was happy to raise the flag of Black Lives Matter in Aurora. That wasn't just a state and local issue. That's also a federal issue.
And claims he did it to appease BLM so they wouldn't loot and burn down his town, which they did anyway.
Yeah, he
so said that was a lie.
Well, he said that a year after the summer of 2020 as well. So
Dr. Nzeke Day, October 2021, and just was all fawning all over her and gave her a plaque and was so happy to be with her.
Well, it's consistent with his fawning all over J.B. Pritzker, who he called a great and compassionate leader. And the Black Lives Matter excuse that he came up with during this campaign is someone who's then conceding that he will submit his public policy choices to extortionists.
Bingo.
Okay. This is impressive to you?
I spoke at an event on Saturday and, just reminded people to study each candidate because Richard Irvin, he is not a Republican. And just listed off what you just said, but people have got to know.
And it's more than he's not just a Republican. It's like, what's the Republican Party anyway? No, it is that he is not going to take the fight to the ruling class in Chicago and Springfield that has destroyed the state because he's underwritten by them, you see. So all those things that he's now saying for the first time that he is going to do or that he supports, to the extent you can get him on the record to say anything specific, he is not going to do. He is pantomiming a Republican, pantomiming an advocate for those positions, because he's in a Republican primary where 3/4 of the electorate identify as conservative, and he is part of a effort to defraud the Illinois Republican electorate yet again. So we'll see. We'll see if people can translate his characterization of Trump in 2018, 2 years in, amid all of the leftist attacks from every direction, that sort of time to appreciate what Trump represented in terms of a popular revolt against the ruling class in D.C. And what is his takeaway? He's an idiot and a bigoted racist. Who is he falling in with? The ruling class establishment here and in the Republican Party here and, of course, at the federal level, too. That's a leading indicator of who he is, which is just an empty suit with ambition, for goodness sakes. How obvious can it be? And who he would be if he was the nominee, and he will never be governor because you're not going to be Jelly Belly with an empty suit trying to pantomime some positions in the primary only to turn around and pantomime different positions in a general. It will not work. And I don't care if Ken Griffin spends $45 billion instead of million. It won't work. So you decide if you have any self-respect for in response to a candidate and a campaign and a Republican Party establishment that has none for you. Don't think they think of you much differently, if at all, than Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden, the deplorables and the dregs. Paul in New Lenox, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, great show as always. When you see the commercial of Irvin, he's always like, cool, calm, and collected. But when I heard this today, oh my gosh, talk about being in full panic mode, backpedaling, and with a forked tongue. It's like night and day. I never thought anybody could talk faster than Ben Shapiro. Amazing.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Paul. Well, when you're bailing water, right, Paul? Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, Dan, I'm trying to figure out from Channel 5 why they're doing what they're doing tonight. But I don't think it's Marianne's fault. I mean, she's trying to have a debate, and those are the ones that are showing up. But what's the real story, right?
Well, do I have to repeat myself? WGN and NBC can't figure out how to have two debates on two separate nights. NBC is having a phony debate with Richard Irvin, not with his primary competitors. That's not
so
a debate.
Weird.
Speaking of Richard Irvin, mayor of Aurora, he touts his mayoralty a lot, what he's done in Aurora. So, yeah, let's compare the records, as he suggested we do. You want to put this on your schedule if you're out west. Thursday, June 2nd, 5 p.m., the city of Aurora is hosting a LGBTQIA flag-making workshop for junior high and high school students. We will be providing small flags that can be decorated to celebrate LGBTQ plus pride or support the LGBTQ plus community. Just join us to make a pride flag for yourself, a loved one, and or just to show support. All materials will be provided. And this pride parade, the LGBTQ plus advocacy, something that was started by Mayor Irvin back in 2018. The parade in Aurora, maybe this workshop as well, it's funded by taxpayers, City of Aurora, but also Indivisible Aurora, which is a group organized to resist the Trump, quote, organized to resist the Trump administration agenda where it offends our American values. Ooh. Oh, yeah. And if you remember on those texts that in that WTTW, Wilmette Talking to Winneka story from last week, where Irvin called Trump a bigoted racist and an idiot. He also had this exchange about the LGBTQIA plus advocacy, Irvin's advocacy, and with a city employee that provided the text to WTTW, in which, of course, in typical fashion, Irvin wanted to have it both ways. We're doing this because it's, you know, inclusive. These people deserve rights. But by the way, they have exactly the same rights that anybody else does, regardless of your gender identity or sexual orientation or anything else. No more rights. No one is opposed to gay rights. We're opposed to supra rights for people based on their gender identity or sexual orientation. Everybody is equal under the law and is afforded the same constitutional protections. The gay rights is a facade for supra rights based on your identity orientation. But anyway, he said that, and then he also said, but you know, I may agree with you. I was taught it was Adam and Eve and Adam and Steve. So he wants it both ways, like he wants it in everything. Everything that this guy does, every position he takes, he will happily take the opposite position or middle the position to try to placate both sides, to flim-flam his way to staying in power or what he's trying to do now, level up. And if a plurality of Republican primary voters are snowed by this, then shame on that plurality of Republican primary voters. But I don't think that's going to happen. It's a statistical dead heat right now, and we got 4 weeks to go, so we'll see.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Former math teacher at the formerly prestigious Grace Church School in Manhattan, Paul Rossi, brings us news of the Pollyanna group. Paul Rossi, by the way, fired as a math teacher at Grace Church because he would not treat his students differently based on their race.
Oh, my gosh.
And this is where we're at.
Our new Pollyanna, normal.
Yes. Pollyanna Inc. High-priced diversity consultant to the nation's most elite and influential K-12 schools. Before they scrubbed their website, their client list included 60 top National Association of Independent Schools, including Horace Mann, Riverdale, and Spence School in New York City, Harvard Westlake in L.A., Casper Calderola, the founder of Pollyanna. She was a former board member at the Dalton School, which is another one of these elite schools, quote-unquote elite schools in New York. The curriculum, the racial literacy curriculum that they are bringing to bear, these DAI consultants at the nation's most elite schools. And by elite, I don't mean in terms of the quality of the education. I mean in terms of the price tag and the net worth of the households that are sending their kids there. The racial literacy curriculum. It is comprehensive. Everything, every subject, every lesson within every subject is to be viewed through the prism of race. For example, it's not art class, it's subversive art class.
Lesson 7 is about culture jamming graffiti art. So in this lesson, students explore the use of street art for critiquing society and broadcasting subversive messages about race and social justice. And then they get to design their own graffiti art pieces using stencils. And their challenge is to design art that challenges their viewers to look at or think about an aspect of race or social justice from a new perspective. And then finally, the last lesson is on Fabiana Rodriguez and printmaking for social justice. We'll talk more about this lesson in just a moment, but students look at the artwork of activist and artist Fabiana Rodriguez and learn about the use of printmaking as a tool for activism, and then they get to create their own prints.
You know what's funny about the subversive art class is it's not subversive if you're being instructed to be subversive. You understand?
Uh-huh.
I mean, you're just an automaton, which is the antithesis of being subversive. You're an apparatchik. English, the English lesson, little snippet.
So the goals in the English curriculum are to use literature to teach students about themselves and others, to support students in grappling with themes of race, identity, and intersectionality, to help students think more expansively about what constitutes a text, and to demonstrate that all texts grapple with identity and race either explicitly or implicitly.
Mm-hmm. Math.
So students learn about DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which currently supports over 700,000 people brought to the United States as children of adoption. And so in the first part of this lesson, students explore the impacts of both individually and on our broader society of the July 2021 court ruling that DACA was unconstitutional. And then in the second part of the lesson, students imagine that they are helping to plan a protest in support of DACA, and they need to determine how to maximize attendance given a variety of outreach options and constraints.
That has nothing to do with math.
What are you talking about? You have to plan how many people you can galvanize to protest the Supreme Court's July 21 DACA decision.
That's still not math. DACA has nothing to do with math.
Well, if you don't think that's math, how about this? More
is
math.
Is this a social warrior class?
Which part of the racial math, like, literacy yes. curriculum is unclear? More math.
And then lesson eight. This is a heavy one, and we definitely recommend that teachers prepare their students and themselves in advance of teaching this lesson. It's about police killings of people of color, and it uses data to explore the racial disproportionality among the victims of police killings and of police use of force. So students examine real-world data to determine that Black and Latinx people are killed by police at rates proportionate to their overall representation in the U.S. population. And then they examine data that debunk the misperception that police kill more Black and Latinx people because those people commit more crimes. And then finally, they consider what it would take to eliminate these disparities.
Don't police kill more white men every year than they do Black and Latinos?
Disproportionate. The purpose of math class is to create students who are antagonistic toward police and believe that police are squads of marauders looking for Black and Latino, or her words, Latinx, kids to kill. That's the purpose of math class.
It's brainwashing kids to let them know that, you know, police are bad and they're not here to help you. They're here to kill you.
Again, this is a high school curriculum at some of the most expensive, most sort of prestigious, in quotes, in terms of status in the country. Health and wellness lesson. So we got your subversive art. You've got your English. You've got your math. You've got more math. How about health and wellness instruction?
Lesson six is about how healthy bodies come in all sizes. This lesson addresses how health can be experienced at every size and debunks the notion that health is defined by body size. Students will learn about how weight-based discrimination often intersects with racial and gender discrimination, and how to think more holistically and inclusively about body size and health. Lesson seven is on redefining beauty. In this lesson, students examine how beauty is defined socially and how the beauty ideal is based in racism, sexism, and ableism, yet harms all of us. And then students learn how to dismantle these narrow standards of beauty. And then finally, lesson eight looks at ancestral trauma and radical empathy. And in this lesson, students reflect on how such ancestral trauma manifests and affects us today, and how trauma is connected to racism and other forms of systemic oppression. Students also learn about radical empathy as a tool to aid in our collective healing from ancestral trauma generally and from racial and systemic oppression specifically.
Radical empathy. Redefining beauty and wellness. You know, that morbidly obese cyclops in your class. That's pretty.
Well, I mean, obesity is being celebrated. Look at the cover of, you know, Sports Illustrated.
Look at the governor's mansion in Illinois. So that's almost a full school day. Huh?
Ancestral. What do they say? Ancestral.
Trauma.
Trauma, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Look, you have a choice. Per the Pollyanna Inc., these dye consultants. You got a choice. You can walk towards the light, or you can stay in the darkness.
You know, they have a choice in terms of how they respond to this information. They can sit in guilt. But are there other ways that they can respond? Are there other emotions they feel? And maybe walking through that process with them. If you're a white person, so as a white person, I often will also share with students my own experience. And I will say, yeah, you know, when I started learning this stuff, I felt really guilty too, but I felt like I got stuck there. And then I started thinking, is there another way I can feel about this? Is there another, what can I do to move myself out of that feeling of guilt? And helping students recognize that there's not going to be just one response or one way to receive this information. It's a process. And it might start with some difficult and painful feelings, but the goal isn't for them to stay there. The goal is for them to evolve their understanding of how race operates in their world. And hopefully, if we break it down for them that way, they can see that that's where they would rather go through the difficult but enlightening process of moving through each of those emotions than stay in the darkness of there's no such thing as racism. Race doesn't matter anymore. We solved racism with a Black president, et cetera. And so I, you know, I, again, I would advise you based on your specific students and the specific situation, but I think giving students a sense of choice, like, okay, you can choose between these two options. One of them is just kind of doing things the way they are, recognizing all the problems and recognizing that then you kind of, you're not in a position of growth, you're in a defensive position. Or what do you think about this option of growing? It's going to be hard, but we're going to get somewhere better and bigger at the end.
You've now just been put through a abbreviated version of one of these train the trainer sessions that your kids' teachers are being put through, or perhaps you've experienced yourself in corporate America. Every aspect of life, every area of study. That's how you want to live? And so when that's happening at K through 12, those quote unquote elite schools in K through 12, and it's been happening for some time, thanks to the work of Paul Rossi and others, Chris Rufo, many others, many other organizations that have sprung up, the parental revolt that's going on in this country, these DAI consultants and these curricula are coming to the light of day. That's the good news. Bad news is it took too long. And so, given that's what's happening in K through 12, government schools, elite private schools, do you now understand what happened to Joshua Katz at Princeton? Just to provide one example, make it concrete. Joshua Katz, one of the leading classics professors in the country. We tackled his story last week along with Dave Sabatini, one of the leading cancer researchers in the world, somebody that was thought to be a likely Nobel Prize winner. Gone, done, over. I won't go into Sabatini again now, but Katz I will, because as predicted, he's been fired.
Oh, he was?
The president recommended to the board, and of course the board followed suit. You think that the public defense of Katz will be nearly enough compared to what Princeton has become?
Yeah.
And the Ivy League generally, both in terms of the student body as well as the professorate, as well as the administration? Of course not. He writes in the Wall Street Journal about his termination today. Why would one of the country's leading educational institutions do this to a successful faculty member who once made a grave mistake? He had a relationship with a student. This is several years ago, more than a decade ago, actually. He was punished for it. He got a year's suspension back in 2018. And then that was revisited. The double jeopardy cultural norm doesn't apply in Princeton if you have the wrong political opinions. And that's what the story is
when
here.
She acted like a victim 2 years later when she'd said nothing before. This woman.
He writes, does Katz, the current environment makes the question all too easy to answer. Why would Princeton do this? In the summer of George Floyd, certain opinions about the state of America that would have been considered normal only a few months earlier suddenly became anathema. For better or worse, I was the first on campus to articulate some of these opinions, publicly criticizing a number of quote-unquote anti-racist demands, some of them clearly racist and illegal, and hundreds of my colleagues had signed on in an open letter to the administration in early 2020. While I stand by my words to this day, even in the immediate aftermath of the faculty letter, few of my colleagues gave signs of standing by theirs. But as they go about their merry, destructive way, I live with a tremendous backlash against me, which has never ceased. It was during a fleeting and illusory lull in late July 2020 after Princeton President Christopher Eisgruber, who had initially condemned me, stated that what I had written was protected speech, after all, that I rashly suggested all was well. So what did I get wrong? There are at least five things of which I was unaware. First, I didn't yet know one of my colleagues had, in her official capacity as director of graduate studies, written an individual letter to every graduate student in the classics department about the pain I had caused. Second, I didn't know yet that in a Zoom session about equity only a couple days later, students and colleagues would badger me to apologize. Third, I didn't know yet that with only a handful of exceptions, almost none of my colleagues would ever speak to me again. Fourth, I didn't know yet that the university would make an example of me to the entire incoming freshman class in August of 2021, singling me out among sitting faculty as a virulent racist, in part by doctoring a quotation from my article. And then there's the fifth thing. I didn't know yet at the end of July 2020, and could scarcely have imagined, that two student reporters at the Daily Princetonian had begun digging into my past in an attempt to destroy me. The result of their investigations was published in early February 2021, whereupon the editor-in-chief wrote an email to her staff about the stellar reporting, which has been in the work for several months. The stellar reporting uncovered the illicit relationship was already known to the administration and for which I had already been punished. Right. But the reporters also made a series of false and outrageous claims about my behavior. As New York Times legal reporter Stuart Taylor put it, the Daily Princetonian's unprecedented investigation and hit piece threw away basic journalistic standards, for no credible newspaper would print an article with such a large number of unnamed sources filled with conjecture and innuendo. But no matter, that was the point. The point was to stir up the mob, which it did. And it stirred up the woman with whom I had the relationship so many years earlier. And as you pointed out, Amy, then she came back and said, oh, I was harassed after, you know, a decade later.
Yeah, in 2018, it was consensual, and she didn't file a complaint, and she wouldn't be interviewed. And then look what happens.
And then the mob was organized, yep, and she folded in with the mob, as did, as he recounts, Joshua Katz, his colleagues and the administration years earlier. And then there was no stopping the inevitable end, which was ending Joshua Katz's tenure at Princeton, which has now happened. But that's the K-12 culture. And this is, you know, going from the campus to K-12 to corporate America. But it has a back and forth. There's a ricochet. It goes down, but it also comes back up. It's self-reinforcing through all these institutions. How can it happen to Joshua Katz? How can it happen to Dr. Sabatini? What are you talking about? You're training an entire generations to be neo-Jacobins, to purge, and to manufacture evidence against those with whom they disagree to purge. I said before, during the French Revolution, it was the Committee on Public Safety that identified those who were to be shown the guillotine. Today, this Marxist revolution, the new Marxist revolution in this country, it's university presidents, boards of trustees, C-suite executives in corporate America, teachers' unions, school board members. They're our version of the Committee on Public Safety. Ralph and Rantoul.
Hey, good morning. It reminds me of two things. Number one, I think some of the parents out there, I know the children that are being taught this garbage are too young to kind of understand some of the subtleties, but it reminds me of the Joseph Conrad novel, The Secret Agent, and the bumbling Marxist-controlled anarchist wannabe who's the protagonist, who is pretty much an idiot being used by his controllers, which kind of reminds me of the idiot instructor person there who is reading things, which leads me to a non sequitur of an old Second City television episode when they're doing a skit and Catherine O'Hara was this bumble-headed idiot who was being used by the people around her, and her comment was to her boyfriend, hey, sex is all they want and that's all I give them. Like somehow that was, she'd put boundaries around that relationship. These people don't realize they're being used and the children need to be protected.
Thanks for the call, Ralph.
You've made the switch and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the World Economic Forum kicked off in Davos. And this cartoonish villain out of like a Team America movie, Klaus Schwab, who founded the World Economic Forum some five decades ago. Well, he welcomed all of the important people in attendance, laying out the global agenda for all of these deep thinkers, for our betters.
Of course.
War and peace, climate change.
Have to address urgently the issue of climate change and all the other issues related to the preservation of nature.
Mm-hmm. But the best part was his We Are the World moment, where he talked about how those in attendance need to bend the world to their collective will, and that starts with the sort of stakeholder capitalism as the operating theory for societal organization.
The future is not just happening. The future is built by us, by a powerful community as you here in this room. We have the means to improve the states of the world. But two conditions are necessary. The first one is that we act all as stakeholders of larger communities, that we serve not our only self-interests, but we serve the community. That's what we call stakeholder responsibility. And second, that we collaborate. And this is the reason why you find many opportunities here during the meeting to engage into very action and impact-oriented initiatives to make progress related to specific issues on the global agenda.
Mm-hmm. We are going to shape the world. We here in this room. It was fun.
They think highly of themselves.
Slightly.
It
was fun to see a reporter from Rebel News in Davos walking up to a cafe where he found New York Times managing editor Rebecca Blumenstein. And this is how that cue and lack of an A went.
Rebecca, how are you doing from the New York Times? Can I ask you a quick question as Avi from Rebel News? How is the public meant to believe that the New York Times is here to actually ask the tough questions when you're here as an invited guest? How are people meant to rely on the mainstream media?
If you wouldn't mind, we're just having if you could give us, thank you.
You don't want to explain to people why we should trust the mainstream media? No? Of course, no comment. There we go. So that's the point here is in Davos you have the mainstream media that are not here to report the truth. They are here as part of the event, invited guests with their white name tags.
That's right. They're the comm shop for Klaus Schwab and those stakeholder, I wouldn't even call them capitalists, although stakeholder capitalism is sort of a contradiction in terms, but stakeholder, globalist doesn't quite capture it either. I mean, they're really stakeholder socialists is what they are because they're government-centric in orientation. And just as the New York Times and the D.C. Press Corps is the comm shop for the Democrat socialists here, on the global stage, it's the comm shop when all the socialists get together in Switzerland. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by Don Boudreau, economist, author, professor, and co-director of the Program on the American Economy and Globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and also a contributor to Cafe Hayek as well, the blog. Don, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Big vision from octogenarian Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum.
Every time I listen to this guy, he really does sound like something that some screenwriter out of Hollywood writes for a James Bond movie. I mean, it's hilarious. I mean, these people are cartoon evil. Mm-hmm. You're right. They are socialists. There's nothing capitalist or market-oriented about them. They're very arrogant. They're going to plan the world. They're going to plan the future. They're going to direct all of us underlings using government power to bring about their vision of what a world economic order ought to be. This is socialism. This is the opposite of the classical liberalism that gave birth to America. It's the opposite of the classical liberalism that gave birth to capitalism and modern prosperity and allowing ordinary men and women to have a standard of living that was unheard of prior to this. These people want to return us to a form of monarchy, a monarchy with a modern face, monarchy run by elites. Who are not descended from warriors, but elites who happen to make a lot of money, ironically, in the market. It's really incredible the failure of these people to be aware of how they come across to ordinary people.
I want you to tackle the term, though, stakeholder capitalism, that is being thrown around. He didn't say that, but he sort of is using that phraseology. Phil Graham, former senator, and Mike Salon from American Enterprise Institute had a piece in the Journal about this. And they write, stakeholder capitalism imperils more than prosperity. It imperils democracy itself. Self-proclaimed stakeholders demand that workers and investors serve their interests, even though no law has been enacted imposing the ESG agenda, the environmental social governance agenda. Break that out for us a bit.
Yeah, so a business is meant to earn profits for the owner, and it earns profits by producing products that consumers voluntarily want to buy, and it serves society best by doing what it's designed to do best, namely produce whatever products that it's in business to produce. But what the stakeholder capitalism people, as they call themselves, want is for businesses not to serve just the interests of the owners, but to serve the interests of the people pushing stakeholder capitalism. So the people pushing stakeholder capitalism want businesses to, promote more equality, economic equality, to do more to protect the environment from these alleged harms that are being inflicted on the environment. And rather than buying enough controlling stakes in these corporations in order to have the businesses do what they want, they simply want to use the law, and they want to use social suasion, moral suasion, to have these businesses divert their attention from what they were meant to do, namely produce products in order to earn a profit, in order to doing what these elites want them to do. It's arrogance of the highest order.
Right,
but it sounds good. It plays really well. Oh yes, stakeholder capitalism. It sounds so good to the unthinking elites in the media and in politics. But when you dig into it, it's a nest of nonsense.
Well, one of the elites in politics, President Biden. I mean, prices at the pump yesterday hit another record high, and his response was that we're in this incredible transition away from fossil fuels. So basically, suck it up. And that there's light at the end of the tunnel. But that's only if everybody buys hybrid or electric cars, which people don't and cannot afford those vehicles.
Yeah, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it, right? Amy, what to say? These people block and obstruct the production of carbon fuels, which are an amazing source of energy. They power the modern economy. When the prices rise, first they blame the oil companies for the price hikes that are due largely to the obstructions imposed by these very politicians. Right? And then they say very blithely, "Oh, well, don't worry about it. You know, we're saving the environment, and there's this, just as you said, there's this great glorious future just across the horizon. And don't worry, when we get there, you'll thank us for bringing you to this brave new world." And we're supposed to trust these people. They've done nothing to engender trust. They've done everything to cause us to be suspicious of both their motives and certainly of their abilities. And yet we're supposed to smile and nod very obediently as they obstruct our lives and throw monkey wrenches into the very processes that make our standard of living possible.
What do we do, though, about private companies and private actors like Larry Fink at BlackRock? What do we do about somebody like that? Because, the question becomes, Do we have corporations folding into the government, or do we have government folding into big corporations like the one Larry Fink lords over when he's pushing this ESG stuff? I mean, do we have to rely on Elon Musk to be the white knight in every sector?
That helps. But fortunately, I'm actually a little bit optimistic on this front. I think the profit motive is so strong that it can overcome lots of Larry Finks. If you have just enough people who are pursuing profits, then that will compel people like Larry Fink to go along or be exposed for the frauds that they are. There is a danger. I mean, if too many people are falling for this nonsense, then we're in trouble. But my sense is that the profit motive remains strong enough worldwide that we'll somehow survive this nonsense. What scares me is the stuff we opened with, Dan. These people in Davos who are not just preaching; they have their hands on levers of power.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, I mean, let me give you another example. HSBC, their global head of responsible investing, Stuart Kirk, has been taken out as punishment for a presentation he did, why investors need not worry about climate risk. And he, among other slides in there, unsubstantiated, shrill, partisan, self-serving, apocalyptic warnings are always wrong. Well, that's completely accurate, and apparently that offended, you know, somebody with the delicate Klaus Schwabian sensibilities. And now their head of global banking is his future, what his future employment will be at HSBC. And so when they can impose that kind of will and political retribution at that level, then why wouldn't people fold in?
Yeah, I saw that story. This guy Kirk seems quite heroic to me.
Yes,
and it's just appalling the treatment he's getting. But I predict that this is going to have negative impacts on the earnings of that bank, and that's what we should hope. That bank deserves to lose money, and sensible investors will move their money to other options that are run by people more sensible. So, again, I'm not sure what to say. We can only hope that the profit motive, that enough people remain motivated
right.
by an honest pursuit of profit to keep the system going.
The only thing worse than relying on the market for a correction would be to rely on the government for one.
Absolutely, because then you'd be relying on people very much like the kinds who are gathered today in Davos. These are really, really scary, arrogant folks.
He is Don Boudreau, economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and a contributor to KFI Hayek as well. Don, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Always my pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay, no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out. I said, when you're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That music means it's time for our weekly conversation with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints.com. And I want to start with this matter of the census numbers, because the U.S. Census Bureau released a report end of last week that it overcounted in some states and undercounted in others. Very interesting.
I don't believe it. Do you?
Yes, I do. But not for Illinois.
Right.
Because the undercount in the six states, five of them red states, they undercounted the population. The outlier is Illinois. In the eight states they overcounted, seven of them are blue states. So five of the six undercounts are red states, like Florida, Texas, Tennessee, Arkansas. Seven of the eight states they overcounted are blue states, like Hawaii, Massachusetts, New York, Delaware. But the matter of Illinois as this outlier in the undercounting, this was an occasion where Jelly Belly tried to take a victory lap, and, you know, that's a big undertaking for him. He released a statement. I ran for governor and I promised to be our state's best chief marketing officer and reverse the trend of outmigration we've seen over the past few decades. The latest numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau show that Illinois is now a state on the rise with a growing population. I look forward to celebrating this development with all Illinoisans, including those who routinely badmouth our state. Gosh, it's interesting. Oh, he has to take note of those who badmouth the state since it's a majority of the population.
Yeah, it said Illinois' population was undercounted by nearly 2%, equivalent of 250,000 people.
So is that right? Illinois is growing again, and that everything undercount is an undercount, that Illinois is back over 13 million, not at 12.8? Well, let's ask Ted Dabrowski. He's looked at it. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me. Hey, Amy.
Should we stop bad-mouthing Illinois?
Yeah, you know, it's a great place. People are flocking to come here. You know, Warren Buffett says he wants to put all his business here.
Right.
No, look, you know, here's what happened, right? When I saw Governor Pritzker and others start to say 13 million is the new population, I was like, okay, well, let's just go to the census and see if we see that number. Did they publish that number? And couldn't find it anywhere. So we did the obvious thing, which nobody else seemed to do. Certainly the media didn't do it. And we called the census, and we asked them to explain those numbers to us. And they said categorically, no, the number is not 13 million. It is still what we reported, you know, a couple months ago. It is still 12.8 million. And, you know, they told us that this is all statistical stuff. There's a very small sample, this testing they do to test their quality. They did a small test. It says that it's potentially 2% undercounted. They tested 0.1% of all households, 0.1% of all households in the United States. And they said that, well, maybe there's an error, but you can't mathematically take that 2% and just add it to the population. They said that would be mathematically wrong. They have no idea. That's not the right way to do it. So,
that's perfect.
Whatever the numbers are, it's just not true that it's 13 million.
It's perfect that Pritzker then took it and ran with it and did exactly that, because why stop being mathematically wrong at the state level in Illinois? That's what we do.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, this is all part of the illusion. And, you know, and it's pretty amazing for Pritzker. And, you know, I guess he's pretty good at it. So let's give him credit. You know, he's managed to turn, the finances into illusion that he and others have done a great job of managing the state finances when they've done nothing. Right. We've talked about that a lot. The $186 billion in COVID aid that's come to Illinois over the last 2 years has just ballooned the coffers of the state, but has nothing to do with Pritzker and what they did. And now he's taking this population thing and turning it into, yeah, we're growing the state again. Look what we've done. You know, not to mention that the IRS didn't say when the population grew. If it did, was it under Rauner, maybe? Was it under Quinn? But Pritzker's going to take the credit for it.
Well, I don't know how it grew under any governor of the the three decades, but if, I mean, it's not much of a trick, really. I mean, he doesn't deserve that much credit. He has a clear field on which to operate. There's no media scrutiny and there's no Republican Party, so of course he can create illusions. Who's going to defy the illusions he's creating?
Yeah, you know, I mean, a perfect example are a lot of the media outlets. You know, I talked to a lot of them. They saw what the census said. And nevertheless, they reported straight, like if it was, yes, population is now 13 million, although every one of them know that that's not true. That's the way the system works. They're speaking the language that Pritzker wants. They're gonna carry the bucket.
Now, you texted us that this book, Two Boys Kissing, is back again at the 10th grade class level at New Trier High School. What happened?
Well, you know, they never got rid of it. There was just a lot of controversy about that book. And again, some people want to say it's controversy because, has same-sex graphic descriptions. And it's not about a same-sex thing. It's about whether it's a two-sex thing. It doesn't belong in the classroom. And it's still there. To New Trier's credit, they've allowed some parents to opt out of the book. You know, I really think that we've got the policy all wrong. If there's a bunch of people that want, you know, books with graphic sex in high school in 10th grade, and, you know, it's stuff that I looked at it. I didn't like it. It's not, it doesn't belong in the classroom. But if parents want that, they should be able to opt in rather than forcing parents who are unaware that there's books like that in the classroom, rather than forcing them to opt out. Let parents opt into this stuff like that.
Well, I mean, they can opt in by, if they want their kids to consume pornography, they can do it at home. They don't need to impose their will on anybody else or waste public resources with this stuff. It's always entertaining, too, when a parent will get up at a school board meeting and read excerpts from this soft porn, and some of it's not so soft, pun intended. That hey, wait a second.
Kids are in the room. Watch what you're saying there, buddy.
You know, put decorum. We can't have this sort of language used. This is a public meeting. Oh, but it's fine in the classroom. It's fine for teachers and kids to pore over it in English class.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. We had some people read that at the board meeting here, you know, in New Trier. But, you know, I would feel very uncomfortable reading that because, that's not how I would speak with people in public. It's just crazy. And so, you know, that kind of stuff, we're going to put out a report here at WirePoints on the public education outcomes, and not just the outcomes, but the whole system. And, you know, when you see the results of how many kids can't read at grade level in Illinois, when you see how many kids can't do math level, and I'm not talking about 30%, I'm talking about 2% of kids only can read a grade level in some schools, 5%. When I start talking about that, and then we're reading books that just aren't even, you know, at the level of educating our kids, it's again, we're upside down.
Well, look, as long as they vote right, what's the difference? You know, as long as they continue to vote for socialists, that's the important thing. You know, mom and dad will always find a soft landing for the kids on the North Shore, so no issues there. This other story that you did that was posted over at wirepoints.com.org takes you to the same place by Matt Rosenberg, revisiting a topic that has become verboten in many circles, which is fatherlessness. From time to time, it's tackled by some politician of the left, but, you know, rarely. And the policy proposals are always in the direction of incentivizing family disintegration, and they continue in Chicago, certainly. But the level of fatherlessness across race in Chicagoland and what that means in terms of policy challenges, economic, as well as educational, as well as public safety related.
Yeah, you know, it's an issue that nobody will touch anymore because, you know, if you say anything, it's racist, they say. But it's a huge problem. And, you know, Matt's done a great job of digging into the data. And, you know, we're finding that the number of births unwed mothers across the state, it's not just a Chicago thing, and it's not just a black thing. It's you know, it's over 80% for blacks. And it's nearly 25% across the state for whites, and in places like
Peoria. Jeez.
Yeah, and you take Decatur. You know, Decatur, 54% of white births were to unwed mothers, and so this is an economic problem. And if we don't tackle it, you know, there's agreement. I don't care what side of the political aisle you're on, left or right, everybody agrees that the unmarried births leads to worse educational outcomes, behavioral outcomes, lower incomes. It's a huge problem, and eventually many of them end up in crime. And so if we don't want to talk about it, you know, the CEO of McDonald's tried to talk about this a couple of years ago and just almost got canceled. You know, Jeannie Ives tried to talk about this in a debate, and she got, you know, yelled at and booed. This is a big issue, and I don't, you know, you can't avoid the problem. You guys talked yesterday a lot about what are the actual crime reforms that we need to actually reduce crime, right? And that's whether we, you know, resume foot chases, resume car chases, you know, start policing more. Those are the things we need to do to bring down crime right now. But if we want to fix the problem over the long term, right, the real solutions are how do you get these people working, you know, not having children before they're born, you know, making sure that they don't have children before high school, all those things are so important, and gosh, nobody wants to talk about it, and it deserves to be talked about.
And what were births to unmarried mothers in the 1950s?
Oh, my goodness. You know, we put that graphic in our piece. Across the country, it was 4%.
Wow.
In Illinois and nationwide, just 4% of births in 1950 were to unwed mothers. And then you can see kind of like, you know, once the policies change in the 60s, in 1970, the trend starts up, and it goes really high for blacks as well. So, it's a major problem.
Yeah, it's one of those things, too. It's everybody, rather than address it, it's just easier to demagogue it. Oh, you're saying something against single moms or I know a single mom who does a great job raising her kids. Yeah, we're not talking about anecdotes. We're talking about sort of generally speaking what we know from a macro analysis of outcomes, what the best outcome for kids and families is. It doesn't mean that people in less than the best situation don't do heroic things and turn out perfectly well and find great success, too. But, you know, the data is so overwhelming in terms of the pathologies that are unleashed with this sort of family disintegration. I mean, it's just not refutable.
No, it's not. And Dan, you know, Matt did a piece this morning telling the story of Latasha Fields.
Sure.
And, you know, she was a single mom at 17, and, you know, she's got a great story to tell. So it's not about people not being able to overcome. But, you know, people tried to attack us a little bit yesterday about, oh, what about, you know, parents that get married? Here's the point. In Decatur, 90% of black kids are born to unwed mothers. 90%. You don't have enough anecdotes to fix that problem, right? 90% is huge. Whites, 54%, 55%. Hispanics, 73%. The problem is, and then when you look at the school scores, indicator, it's not going to be a successful city because there aren't enough people who are ready for the workforce and who will have the wherewithal to succeed. So if we don't attack that problem, we're screwed.
It's also just logic, too. It's, you know, oh, fathers don't matter. Ask somebody if their father mattered to them. I mean, yeah, there'll be exceptions. There were bad dads and intact families and all the anecdotes that provide exceptions to the rule. But as a rule, if you surveyed a representative sample of the American public, regardless of race, so representative sample, so disproportionate to the racial composition as well, do fathers matter? Did your father matter to you? You're going to get an overwhelming response to the positive. Of course you are.
Oh, hell yeah. And if you just look at, two-parent households, how well they do in incomes. They're not in poverty. Educational outcomes are better. Everything is better when you have intact households. And of course, you know, again, on a macro basis, everything is far worse when you don't have two parents. And we're talking about statistically, right? Not the anecdotes, not the individual stories, because there are many good stories, but the numbers are overwhelming, and it's something that I think, you know, Obama, we wrote about Obama, you know, he actually, you know, talked about that subject. How far did he take it? Not very far, but he started it.
He is Ted Dabrowski, president of wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, one of our favorite inquisitors during the Russian collusion hoax and the Mueller investigation was former South Carolina Congressman Trey Gowdy. He was on with Martha McCallum to talk about the disclosure by Robbie Mook on Friday that Hillary had green-lighted the Russian collusion fraud that was perpetrated by her campaign, I would say, by the FBI, by the D.C. press corps, on the American public. And he makes a good point about a question that we still don't have an answer to. This didn't begin with Michael Sussman, this skullduggery that was afoot. So why did it begin?
I don't remember Mueller interviewing Secretary Clinton. I do remember the FBI interviewing her over the July 4th. That was mid-year exam. That was another FBI investigation where they, of course, you may recall, Martha, but your point is accurate. I mean, they allowed fact witnesses in on that interview. They went ahead and told her defense team ahead of time, and they'd actually made the decision not to charge her before they ever interviewed her. So, look, I know the FBI considers itself to be the victim in this case. I mean, they believe that they were duped by Michael Sussman. But, Martha, this is not where the Russia investigation began. It did not begin in the fall of 2016. It may have begun in 2015. And it wasn't because Michael Sussman showed up. Something in the Bureau made them interview or investigate the Trump campaign way back in 2015, way before this Perkins Coie lawyer showed up in Jim Baker's office. I don't think so. I think what we're learning is that you and I, Martha, cannot get an interview with the general counsel of the FBI. You and I probably can't get an interview with a field agent in Topeka, Kansas. But a Democrat lawyer that everyone in the world that has access to the internet knows that the DNC lawyer can march into Jim Baker's office and say, I need you to take a look at this. And now the FBI wants you to believe that they're the victim. I mean, they're the victim in this prosecution. This is a lying to the FBI case. So just forgive me for not viewing the FBI as the victim. They initiated an investigation in early 2016. Then you got Peter Strzok and Operation Crossfire Hurricane. All of this predates Michael Sussman. So they were looking at Trump. And what I want Durham to tell us is why. What was the factual predicate for looking at the Trump campaign well before this DNC lawyer marched himself into the FBI general counsel's office?
For more on this, please be joined by Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, contributing editor at National View and author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks for joining us. Is Trey Gowdy asking the right question?
Yeah, I hope he's not only asking the right question. I hope we'll someday get an answer to it. Most days I'm pessimistic about whether that's going to happen or not. But, look, I in the book I wrote about this back in 2019, my theory, and I haven't seen anything to shake me off it, is that this more likely originally went back to the CIA than the FBI, and that John Brennan at the CIA was kind of the clearinghouse for all negative information about Trump, a lot of it collected from overseas, and it was leveraged in behalf of Democratic Party politics and the Clinton campaign. And my theory was that the FBI was kind of late to the party, and they were not willing to stick their necks very far out. And one of the interesting aspects of this, which I wrote about over the weekend, is that the FBI actually exploded the Trump-Russia collusion scenario 8 days before the election by leaking to the New York Times that they hadn't found any evidence of sinister connections between Trump and Russia. And of course, the New York Times is kicking itself years later for publishing that. But they did it because everybody assumed Mrs. Clinton was going to win the election and they were just trying to clear the decks. I really didn't think, Dan, that the FBI got very aggressive on this until after the election. I know they did a lot of stuff they shouldn't have done before the election, but they weren't committed to this the way, before the election that they were after. And I think Trey is right to say that there's a lot of indication that this goes back to 2015, and I just don't think the FBI was a very active player in it back then.
Well, if not the FBI, and if the CIA, as you said, that certainly stands to reason to me. But it's not been so much part of the conversation of late. But I got to think that Durham, being a sophisticated guy, is thinking about the same questions and pursuing answers that are being raised by you, by Trey Gowdy, by others, and including not just sort of narrow casting to the FBI and the Clinton campaign, but to all potential parties to this fraud, including Brennan or whoever at the CIA.
Yeah, one of the things that I was concerned about
And it's guided my thinking a lot. You know, I get people want to throw stuff at me when I say I think that for the most part, Durham has decided that to the extent there was a big scheme here to leverage the, you know, the law enforcement and intelligence apparatus of the government against Trump and in favor of the Clinton campaign, and later after the election in favor of the Democrats' political interests, I think that Durham decided that a lot of that was more abuse of power than violations of the criminal law. And one of the key things I rely on here is that he apparently conducted an 8-hour interview with Brennan some months back. And the interview, according to press reporting, and I have no reason to doubt the accuracy of this reporting, the interview proceeded on the premise that Brennan was not a subject of the investigation. But yet it was a very, apparently it was a very challenging interview for him. So my, you know, just reading the tea leaves from that, what I suspect is happening is that Durham's going to write a very tough narrative report at the end, which lays out a lot of abusive things that happened in the government. But I don't know that that's going to be very satisfying for people if that doesn't get matched up with criminal indictments.
Yeah, but when is the end going to be? Like, how much longer do we have to wait for the final report?
Yeah, Amy, I feel like I've been potentially wrong about that, because my opinion up until about 3 weeks before the Sussman trial was that Durham was at the end, that he's got this false statements case against Sussman. He's got another false statements case coming up in a couple of months against this guy, Igor Danchenko, who's involved in the Steele dossier end of this. And I figured he'd get those done and then write his report. His report should be being written now, you would figure, and call it a day and be done by the end of this year, if not before. But what he said in the last 3 weeks is that he still has an active investigation and that more charges are possible. One of the reasons this guy, Rodney Jaffe, who's involved in the Sussman stuff, one of the reasons that he hasn't testified in this trial is he wanted immunity because Durham has told him he's still the subject of an active investigation. So it's possible that there'll be more charges. But the one thing, you know, before people get too hyped up about that, I keep having to point out to people, this is like getting no attention, but it ought to be in the front of our minds rather than the back of our minds. The statute of limitations for most federal crimes is 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And most of what we're hearing about in the Sussman case took place in 2016 into 2017, but not all that far into 2017. And even The surveillance on Carter Page ended in, what was it, July or August of 2017. So, you know, there are ways that prosecutors can try to extend the statute of limitations, like by conspiracy theories and that sort of stuff. But you can only do so much, and we're really up against the end of the 5 years now.
That's a good point. Just on you know, the desire that people have to hold the principal actors accountable in some way and potentially criminally, if there is any possibility that criminal law was violated. Based on what we know at this point and what has been unearthed since these indictments were handed down and now the Sussman trial being prosecuted by Durham, is there anything that you see or you could conceive of where Hillary Clinton, Jake Sullivan, senior members of the Clinton campaign could be charged with a criminal violation?
I think what that comes down to, Dan, is remember that Durham wanted to prove the narrow false statement by Sussman within the context of what he called the joint venture,
mm-hmm.
which is this whole notion that the Clinton campaign concocted the Trump-Russia scenario, the political narrative. They peddle it to the media. They try to entice the FBI into investigating it, and then they want to go public with the idea that the charges are so serious that the FBI is looking into them, right? That's the kind of framework scheme. But I always thought it was, I refer to it as a conspiracy to defraud the government, because that was the closest criminal analog that I could come up with. But I think it's telling that Durham has never referred to it as anything other than the joint venture. He hasn't called it. He's used conspiracy principles to argue why he should be able to put the evidence in, but he hasn't called it a conspiracy. And I don't think he's made up his mind whether that thing was criminal or not. I think he thinks it stinks to high heaven, and it was corrupt, and it was deceptive. But the question is, one thing he hasn't made up his mind about, for example, is this Alpha Bank data.
Right.
Did they overinterpret stuff that was true, or did they just flat out make up stuff against Trump? And the FBI, the CIA seemed to think some of the stuff was just flat out made up. Durham said he hadn't made his mind about whether the CIA was right about that. So the reason I raise all this is because there's a important but nuanced difference between people who are politically motivated, who see stuff and spin it as badly as it can be spun against their political opponent out of zeal to win the election, versus people who knowingly make up false things in order to defraud the United States and peddle on them things that are just knowingly false. And I think to get at the people you're talking about, you'd have to be able to prove the second thing. And I don't think Durham thinks he's there.
Hmm. There was an interesting op-ed at Issues and Insights, I think it was. I had forgotten about this. It's been so long, so much water under the bridge. But impeachment 2.0 of Trump, the argument was made by congressional Democrats that you can impeach and convict a president upon leaving office. This was a interpretation that was kicked around quite a bit. Well, how about in 2023, when Republicans take control of the House and Senate, you go back and you impeach Hillary Clinton to at least have something on her permanent record, as it were?
Well, you know, look, I made this argument in 2016. I don't think there's any plausible argument that you can't impeach a person who's not in office. That there's nothing in the Constitution. Not only is there nothing in the Constitution that says you can't do that, I wrote a book about impeachment back in 2014. The framers' model for impeachment was the impeachment of Hastings by Edmund Burke, which was going on at the same time the Constitution was being written toward the end of the 18th century. And Hastings had been out of office for a long time when Parliament impeached him. And the remedy for impeachment is not just removal from office and you know, having power stripped. It's also disqualification from future office. So I as a legal proposition, I just don't think it's a very viable argument that you can't impeach someone unless the person is in office. So I do think former office holders are open to impeachment. I made this argument about Hillary Clinton in connection with the emails back in 2016, and I don't think it's any less viable an argument. I wouldn't expect there to be a great groundswell for it, but I think legally it's plausible.
He is Andy MacArthur, former Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney in Manhattan, contributing editor to National Review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Have a great week, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Here's a bit of a story of turnabout. Tyler Fisher is a Brooklyn-based comedian and comedic actor. He's been on shows like John Oliver's This Week Tonight, or Last Week Tonight, or whatever the hell it is. He's been on Chicago Med. But just as an aside, all these Chicago shows, Chicago Med, Chicago Fire.
Yeah, what about them?
Is it me, or are they just just terribly mawkish and treacly and unwatchable.
Yeah, they're a little cheeky, but people that love them are dedicated. They shot a Chicago PD down our street, and it was cool. The whole cast loved Bubba, by the way. They stopped shooting to take a little break to have a bulldog love fest.
Yeah.
But yeah,
they
no, people
stop
are
shooting
intrigued.
To take a break to go to an acting class or a writing class.
Oh, it's
those
just
shows
a,
are unwatchable.
It's a late night soap opera, is what it is.
So he's done work, and so yes. He wanted to sign with this Manhattan agency, this talent agency, AGI, and he says, I was ready to sign the papers, and that when a conversation took a turn. This is after he had the initial conversation. They were talking to him about auditioning for Curb Your Enthusiasm and other shows that he loved, and he's like, they seemed excited. And then when he was ready to sign, the assistant there at this talent agency, quoting him, and apparently recorded him, so he's got the direct
recorded
quote.
Recorded him?
The assistant there told him, we love you, everyone here loves you and thinks you're a star, but we're not taking you because you're white.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And Tyler Fisher, the comedian, for clarity's sake, asked the question to make sure that he heard him right, quoting, again, from a recorded phone conversation, so you guys like me, you want to work with me, you know I've got what it takes, but the only reason is because I'm white? And the AGI representative said, yeah. So now he's suing AGI for racial discrimination. And he has tweeted out that AGI attempted to make him a settlement out of court, but he refused to settle out of court. He wants his case to be heard. He tweeted, I'm currently suing a town manager who told me they won't work with me because I'm a white man. They just asked me how much money I want to settle out of court. Update, I will not settle. I will take this all the way, even if I don't get a dime. This justified, quote-unquote, racism must end. And he also said, I have endless people reaching out to me, privately saying this happened to me. I'm too afraid to speak out. I had an acting agent reach out to me the other day who said, you have no idea how bad it is. They're not hiding it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he is a talented guy. He's had some success here. I don't know if he played some of these send-ups he's done and posted on YouTube, but some good ones. For example, this is Tyler Fisher. Every NPR show.
Good morning and welcome to NPR. A quick trigger warning. If you're a human with emotions, you may want to avoid this program. Today on the show, we talk about racism again. We interview Robin DiAngelo, a white woman who makes $50,000 a pop telling massive corporations over Zoom that their white employees are the devil. We then ask you, the listener, are you racist? If you say yes, you obviously are. If you say no, you're in denial, which means you obviously are. You then get even more defensive because you truly claim to not be racist, so that when we accuse you of being racist over and over, that's really annoying and kind of crazy. But the more defensive you get, the more we call you racist. The more we call you racist, the more defensive you get. Until you're so infuriated from being called racist based on just the color of your skin, which is actually the definition of racism, that believe it or not, you may over time become a little racist. Making us right all along. And just a reminder, this is a publicly funded show, so all of you racists are actually paying for it. Coming up, should your animals be vaxxed, and how does that relate to the patriarchy? We'll be right back. Racist.
And so now a parody has become real life for Tyler Fisher. And it's interesting how he said they're not hiding it. Yeah, the talent agent was pretty straightforward with them. We like you. We think you're great. We think you're going to do well. We're not taking you because you're white. And, you know, I've got a couple of friends that are sort of involved in the Hollywood and music industry, and they will tell you what's happening as the stories that Tyler Fisher was relaying with people reaching out to him now that this suit has gotten some public profile. There's friends of friends who are songwriters. It's a husband and wife team.
Yeah.
They're white. They cannot submit songs for consideration directly. They have to use a minority cutout in order to submit songs if they want their songs to get picked up by these recording artists. The same
so
thing.
So they still write it. Like, it's a, they have a ghost, kind of like a ghost writer.
Well,
They're the writers, and they use.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. That's. I mean, you have to lead with, you know, a acceptable identitarian front, or you're not. Your work won't be considered on the merits. And I guess that shouldn't be surprising in those industries, except to the extent that they want good work product, so it's consumed by the public and they make money. But I guess the public consumes a lot of crap, too, so they probably make money either way. I suppose that's the thinking. Tyler Fisher, another one. Just to show you, this guy does have chops. And you can see how he would be good as in some character role on a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode. Tyler Fisher's message to the unvaxxed.
Yeah, hi. This is just another little message to the unvaccinated, a.k.a. the devil. I am so happy they are doing these vaccine mandates here in New York City, because I do not want any of you terrorists next to me while I'm eating a meal, okay? And, of course, the least vaccinated by race are cis white men. What a surprise, because they are professionals at killing people. Don't believe me? Let's look at the numbers. 50% of whites are not vaccinated. Yuck. 70% of blacks, my brothers and sisters, are doing the right thing. 70% are not vaccinated. Wait a minute. 70% of blacks are not vaccinated, so they're not allowed in bars, restaurants, or movie theaters. Okay, Black Lives Matter, but just maybe 30% of them, right, at the... Climate change is real.
Mary Kay in Western Springs, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Chicago residents, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's right. I used to go down there and, like, watch, Kevin Costner film from a movie with whatever. I used to hang out and watch it because, you know, we were young and we thought that was cool. Now I could care less. But, Amy, Dan, you said he recorded his interaction with the people he was trying to get hired by. And, yeah. Amy, you just questioned it. So did he record it legally?
I don't know the particulars of who was on the call. New York is a one-party consent state, means only one party must consent to the recording of an in-person telephone conversation.
It's legal.
So probably it's fine, yeah.
Okay, well, even the parodies these days just make my head spin. I hear you guys giggling in the background, and I'm like, wait, is this parody? Is this real?
Exactly.
You know, oh, my God. You know, that's the where we're at now. Like, nobody knows. Are we black? Are we white? Are we this? Are we that? Are we male? Are we female? It just... I almost feel like it's time to take a break again, you know, for a couple of weeks and just go chill somewhere. This is just getting, you know, Amy, I know how you feel. It's exhausting. Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to go get a big massage and go lay in a pool somewhere. And I don't know, let it all get out of my head. Mm-hmm. You know, what are you going to
right.
do?
I'm
play some golf.
Dan will sponsor us.
Go to your happy place, Mary Kay.
Dan, could
right,
you
thanks
get
for the call.
Dual massages for me and Mary Kay?
We don't have massages at Olympia Field.
Darn it. What about a mani pedi before we play 18?
Well, yeah, we'll see what kind of package we can put together. And I don't mean that in the way that Philadelphia
package.
School teachers mean that when they're talking about their private parts.
Thank you.
And enhancing through prosthetics their private and all that. She's right though. Like his unvaxxed parody mm-hmm. is not really a parody. It's just an impersonation of any number of people who've been captured by libs of TikTok. Really is. I mean, it's just impossible to satirize the left. Kevin in Austin, Texas.
And it's also a very serious branding campaign that the Democrats are trying to paint all Republicans. And conservatives especially, as racist. I mean, he came out on
what else
Morning Joe the other day and talked about it. But it's just on that level of saying the quiet part out loud, and it's a very specific, direct branding campaign. So
yeah, thanks for the call, Kevin. I mean, we have that going on in Georgia today, actually. Interesting. Stacey Abrams, you know, she's running unopposed for the socialist nomination to run against probably – I think it won't be close. The incumbent governor, Brian Kemp, who will win his primary today in Georgia. But Abrams, who, by the way, never conceded defeat in 2018, that election was stolen. So it's okay for the majority of Democrat socialists to believe the 2016 election was stolen or rigged. It's okay for Stacey Abrams to believe the 2018 Georgia gubernatorial election was stolen or rigged. It's not okay for anyone to suggest that there was any rigging going on in 2020 on behalf of the Biden. I got it. I get the standard, which is whatever's in my interest, right? Without, there's no principle at stake here. I got that. Stacey Abrams was asked about voter suppression, given that prior to today's election day in Georgia, you have record early turnout, 2x what it was in 2018 when she last ran and lost to Brian Kemp, and she will run and lose to Brian Kemp again this cycle. And this is what she said. This is a fun response.
We are seeing record-breaking numbers with the early vote. And I asked her about this. You know, the progressives, organizers in this state, lots of concerns about the voting law signed by Kemp last year, calling that law racist. Well, I asked her how, if she would still characterize that law as racist in the wake of so many Republicans and Democrats coming out in this early vote period.
But we have to remember that voter suppression isn't about stopping every voter. It's about blocking and impeding those voters who are considered inconvenient. The moral equivalent of saying that voter turnout diffuses or disproves voter suppression is like saying that more people getting in the water means there are no longer any sharks.
But specifically, was it a racist law?
We believe that these laws were designed to respond to the turnout that we saw in 2020 and 2021, and that was namely turnout among people of color, young people, and communities that were disadvantaged. And so I continue to be deeply concerned about who the targets are and who will be undermined.
Deeply concerned. Well, could you explain the 2X in early voting? And could you explain, well, after the end of today, the voting today in Georgia, can you explain the turnout and the distribution of it? The statement she made, the moral equivalent of saying that voter turnout diffuses or disproves voter suppression is like saying that more people getting in the water means there are no longer any sharks. Huh. Okay. Voter suppression likelihood is equal to shark attack likelihood. That's 1 in 3.7 million or 0.00026%. So if that's what she thinks the likelihood of voter suppression is, I think we can all live with that. Rob and Morris here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, in reference to this what actor that didn't get this position, was it something that was written for a black actor or is it the agency itself? I didn't hear the whole story not going to take him on because he's white.
No, it's the agency itself. It wasn't for a specific role. It was to represent him as his creative agent for his professional career, generally.
I appreciate the explanation. I didn't catch the whole thing, or I didn't even know if that was mentioned at all. So yep. Thank you for that.
Yep. Thanks, Rob. Don Bloomingdale.
You know, guys, one thing I've learned through the coronavirus thing is I don't need Hollywood entertainment anymore. I've substituted other things like family and just, doing things personally, volunteering. And if this is the way they want to treat each other, then this is what they designed. That live by the sword, die by the sword. This is the world they created. Good luck.
Well, I agree with that generally, but it's also you want to encourage somebody like Tyler Fisher, who is trying to raise this issue that would benefit others too, who are, as he mentioned, too afraid to come forward. So you appreciate somebody that is taking up fights that should be taken up, that is calling out racism wherever it manifests itself, and and striking a blow for a more, fair, productive, thoughtful, rational culture. So you encourage him. I mean, I hear what you're saying. I have no love lost for Hollywood or the entertainment industry either, but I do appreciate Tyler Fisher taking up this cause. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.